Ann Trubeck, she is just about the, I think she might have invented the phrase Rust Belt Chic. We'll ask her about that. She also publishes Belt Magazine, which is a return to the old days when journalists used to write things. Pretty amazing stuff. Would you welcome, please, Ann Trubeck, ladies and gentlemen, to our stage. Hello again.
How are you?
Hi.
I've got the book, The Cleveland Anthology. This is kind of a throwback to an earlier age of journalism, isn't it? With a lot of what you're doing.
Yeah. We see a certain gap in the amount of in-depth, complex journalism and essay writing happening from the Rust Belt and lots of places that aren't served by the coastal media.
Yeah. But so, everywhere, really.
Everywhere, if you're not out in the coast, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we're trying to fill that gap with our online magazine as well as books that are about individual cities around the Rust Belt.
Yeah, but you're not from here.
I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin.
You did?
I am. Yeah.
That's where I grew up, too. Not originally, but my second time around. Yeah, so part of this has been a learning experience for you as well, but what attracted you to the whole Cleveland?
What's not to love about Cleveland, right?
The Cleveland thing. I agree. I totally agree.
And, you know, as a writer and as an editor, as a publisher, there's so much that hasn't been served. There are so many great stories. There's so much fascinating stuff happening now as well as historically. And I just wanted to help tell those stories.
Yeah. And do you give internships and so forth for journalists if they want to, you know?
Well, we definitely have a huge slew of freelance writers and staff. Everyone's paid. The intern thing is, you know, we don't do unpaid internships.
You don't. Well, that's a good thing. Because I was looking for one, but that's all right. If we don't.
Oh, right. No, for you, we'll talk.
Yeah, okay. I got enough put away.
Cleveland rates.
Yeah. And what about the phrase itself for Rust Belt Chic?
I would love to take credit for it, but I can't. It was actually termed by Harvey Pekar's wife.
It was.
Joyce Brabner.
Yeah.
And she used it to describe the attitude of sort of hip New Yorkers who would show up and be like, oh, cool, the Rust Belt, like, you know, vacant factories and beer. But we sort of use it to describe both that sort of ironic sense of the term, but also a sincere sense of the term, in that there are really fascinating things happening here. And it's a good way to sort of describe both the negative and the positives.
Yeah. Harvey Pekar was on my show. One of the first shows we did here. Yeah.
Really?
I loved him, but he scared me.
He's a scary
guy.
He
wouldn't let you off on anything. You know, he would pin you on anything. And I didn't even know I had to answer for what I said.
I should have
until
listened.
I met Harvey Pekar. You know, and he made you, but he was great, you know.
Yeah, he's Cleveland's best writer ever.
And quintessentially Clevelandian.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Because, I mean, what did he work for? The
VA.
For the VA.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, and so many of the characters in the cartoons that they were doing were actually people who he worked with and stuff, and they were all.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like two-fisted intellectuals, regular guys.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. We got him here in Cleveland.
Yeah. That's a good thing. And then, when you did the anthology itself, this is part of a series, right? A different.
Yes. We've done a book. These are collections of essays by Clevelanders about various aspects of the city. Or sometimes it's ex-Clevelanders, because we have a huge number of ex-Clevelanders, given depopulation over the decades.
Yeah.
And we've done similar books about Youngstown, Pittsburgh. We have one coming out about Flint next month.
Yeah.
We've covered Detroit, someone's going to be mad that I'm at Cincinnati.
Since you mentioned Detroit,
yes.
What is that? Now you mentioned that, like, Clevelanders, let's say, is there another way of saying it? Clevelanders are somewhat insular. Like, someone was quoted something that was written by you, or he'd never been to Detroit.
Right.
That's kind of odd. I mean, it's not that far away. I mean, I'm
That's
from
right.
Milwaukee, but I've been to Chicago.
Right.
What is that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I'm not sure the answer, but I do think that Clevelanders are very prideful of their city. They love their city. But as you know, you said Milwaukee is, you know, Cleveland's doppelganger. There are so many other cities right nearby that are very, very similar and have similar problems that they're struggling with, as well as histories and immigration patterns. So I don't know, is it a little bit of too much pride? We're not, as Clevelanders aren't as interested in what's happening in Detroit and Pittsburgh and Milwaukee. That is, you know, very similar to what's happening here. Or maybe, I don't know, University of Michigan? I don't know.
Are there Clevelanders who've never been to Parma?
I bet there have. We also have in Cleveland, we have an east-west divide, which is very profound.
Yeah, so, what is, explain that.
I don't know, but because I'm not from here, I find it mystifying. But I met someone once who's, you know, he's 40, and he's from the west side. He says, I've only been to the east side 4 times in my life.
Did he say what for?
For the museum.
For the museum? Okay. Yeah. But you never got beyond it and find out why that. I guess you just.
I mean, what's really at the root of that?
Their neighborhood rooted. Is that what you're saying?
There's a lot of race involved in the division. There's sort of a working class, professional class issues involved. It's strange.
Yeah. What about this phrase, "ruin porn"? What does that mean?
Those beautiful vacant buildings that you were talking about—that's ruin porn.
Okay.
It's the beauty that is really, you know, based on poverty, neglect, and terrible post-industrial circumstances that creates these actual, you know, ruins that are sad, but also can be aesthetically gorgeous. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole sort of genre of like, oh, look at, Michigan Central Station, Eastern Station is the epitome of it. This beautiful old buildings that are just completely covered with vines, windows all gone, copper's been taken out, but have a certain beauty nonetheless.
Yeah. What is your magazine doing with the RNC? How are you approaching that?
That's a good question. So what do you do? What does anyone do, right? Nobody knows what it's going to be like.
Yeah.
It's such an uncertain thing. So what we decided to do was we're going to announce them on Monday or Tuesday, 2 fellowships for people to come and to be journalists in town during the whole time, but not talk about Trump, not talk about the delegates, not even go inside the queue, but to really just sort of look at what's happening in the city during those times. And we're going to try to get as many people as we can, many of them who aren't from Cleveland, to sort of approach it with a sort of ethnographic eye about what's happening in Cleveland. I'd love also to start doing some of the statistics that you cited about what the security is going to be like, where the money from the city is going, as well as if we're going to even get all the money that the host delegation needs.
Yeah.
Because there's some sponsor issues. So we're going to try to follow it the best we can.
So you won't have a man on the floor like Dan Rather in 68 getting carried out by...
We applied for the press pass. So, you know, if the RNC wants to listen to this and make sure we get a press pass, then we'll go down on the floor, too, and do our special Cleveland brand of yelling.
Yeah. What's the word on the street about, you know, Donald Trump, stupidly, obviously... almost guaranteed a riot if he didn't get the vote,
right.
his delegate and so forth. I don't know why anyone would say that. Doesn't make sense for him as
right.
well as anyone else. And then they're talking about days of rage now. Cleveland, you know, one of the Republican guy, and he's an old guy. He remembers the days of rage. You know, 68 was a long time ago.
Yeah,
he said it's going to happen here, and they're working it.
Yeah,
what do people think about? They think, are there people organizing here to disrupt the convention or what's going on?
It's so hard to know. I mean, nobody predicted Trump, so how are we going to predict what happens in July?
Yeah.
I do have a sense that the people who were anticipating to come to protest before Trump, the anti-GOP in general, Black Lives Matter people, social justice people, I think they have a smaller presence than they anticipated because of how strange the potential other sorts of protests might be, and activists' presence, and the Trump protesters, and all of that. So I think a lot of people are, you know, maybe want to stay away and watch cable.
Yeah. So they're not going to coronate a pig as president. They're not doing the the yippie approach. There's none of that.
No, there not that I've seen. And if there is, you know, get in touch because I'd love to, you know, find people.
I don't want to plant ideas in anybody's head. You know, there wasn't much economic benefit from Chicago except for the Chicago 7 trial. That was entertaining. But
I do think Cleveland 6, people do say, oh, yeah, it's going to be Chicago 68, Cleveland 16.
Really? Who said
that? Well, the audience doesn't like that.
Who said that? Some of the other things that you're doing now, the Skeptic's Guide, you're involved in a lot of things. I love the Skeptic's Guide to Writers' Houses. I actually haven't seen the book, but that's a wonderful idea.
Thank you. Actually, that's a book that I did, published a few years ago, that was before I started Belt, where I went around to different writers' houses, museums across the country, and tried to figure out why they're appealing to people, and interviewed the curators and looked into the histories of the writers themselves, like the Key West, Hemingway Key West house is very famous, but then, you know, there's this wonderful poem.
Did he not die in Key West? Because I read in...
he died in Ketchum, Idaho, in another house, which I also went to, where he killed himself.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting place to visit.
Boy, I would have stayed in Key West for rather than go all the way to Idaho to do it. It seems like an odd thing to do. And it's sort of curious, why do people go to the... It's like a pilgrimage if you love a writer and you want to see... But do you learn something about them from that? And what about the houses they demolished? Who is it? Langston Hughes?
That's right. There's Cleveland. There's the house that Langston Hughes lived in Cleveland. It was just for a few years when he was in high school. Is here, and they're not clear. It's just not a museum. Also, a wonderful Cleveland writer, Charles Chestnut, who is really undeservingly unknown, to use a lot of uns.
Yeah, he was very famous in his day.
Exactly. He lived in the central neighborhood, and his house is long gone, and would be wonderful to try to at least have some sort of marker to him. To me, the best way to honor the legacy of a writer is to read their books or distribute their books to people who have not read them, rather than worry about, you know, the gutters and the, you know, replacing the windows on the house that they used to live in. But a lot of people find it incredibly meaningful and transformative, and that's what I learned when I did my travels around.
And Hart Crane from here?
Hart Crane is from here. He grew up in Chagrin Falls, and then he lived in Cleveland a little bit. And there is no there's a park. There's a park down by the river, the Hart Crane Memorial Park, which I bet a lot of people in this audience didn't even know. but it's a sweet little place to go and think about the very difficult, troubled life of Hart Crane.
Yeah, great writer, though. But he didn't write about Cleveland. He wrote about Brooklyn.
Right.
Yeah.
He didn't like Cleveland.
I think there's been some long-term resentment, probably.
He didn't like Cleveland. He kept going back and forth. His father would make him go work here, and he didn't want to, but he'd have to because he didn't have any money, and then he'd go to New York, and then he'd come back.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that you're doing, I don't mean to tell you what you're doing, because you know
Please,
that.
This is great. Tell everyone.
The history and uncertain... future of handwriting.
That's right.
I find this very personally because my cursive is getting really bad, for one thing. But nuns are the only ones now who have cursive handwriting, right? They are the carriers. It's like, you know, the monks when they were preserving civilization by their manuscripts. Right. Now the nuns in there, because they keep journals.
And the inmates.
Nuns and inmates.
I've received a lot of letters from prisoners.
I bet the nuns' cursive is better, though, than...
No, you'd be surprised.
I would be surprised.
Yeah. So that's a book that of mine that comes out in a few months on the history of handwriting. And
I think it's so important because it's a different place in the brain where you write with and where you input things on a keyboard. It's totally different. You look at me, I'm very analog here. I write on legal pad and can't read it. But you're actually writing, and there's a writing gland or lobe in your brain somewhere. If you're inputting things, you're typing. It's a different skill.
Sure, but how good are you at carving on walls?
Good. Very good. With a spray can, I'm
How are your hieroglyphs?
Yeah, I'm good at tagging walls. I don't know about... What are you saying?
There's been lots of different ways to write over the millennia, right? Whether you're making marks in cuneiform tablets or doing hieroglyphs or...
that's true.
Yeah. So if you look at it in the long... term of history, it becomes a different set of discussions.
And but you know what? I think all this, you know, phone stuff and texting and abbreviations, it's a way how not to write. It's a way to avoid writing. You know, you can send out a text message and it's like a code or something like that, but you're not crafting a sentence. I love to craft a sentence.
Okay, I'm going to be Harvey Pekar here.
Okay,
so I think that most of the people here in this room would agree with me if I said that you do more writing now than you did 20, 30 years ago.
But it's texting.
Text is writing. Email is writing.
Yeah.
Twitter is writing. Facebook is writing.
But it's not composing.
It is. People compose.
On the fly, you know. It's like, and it's all abbreviations, and it's like, you know, JK, LOL.
But there were lots of... Those monks,
stuff I get from my daughters.
But those monks who preserved great writing, those manuscripts are also filled with abbreviations.
Well, fine for them.
Should we move on?
No, but also, I mean, it's a way of avoiding conversation and actually personal. I mean, besides killing writing, I think it's killing personal interaction. They call it social networking, but there's nothing social about it.
Socrates. Socrates was like, this writing thing, this newfangled thing is terrible. No one's going to talk to each other, and the really great communication happens when you're face to face.
Yeah. Belt Magazine.
Magazine.
Do we mention it?
Yes.
It's unique.
It is unique. We are the only a publication dedicated to the Rust Belt. We're independent, editorially independent. We started just 2 years ago. And we're really, you know, having a lot of fun and publishing stories that aren't being published elsewhere.
What is the Spring Salamander Gauntlet? I take my notes. I don't understand my notes. It says Spring Salamander Gauntlet.
You do great research.
Yeah.
We're going to really, really miss you.
I'm not dying, by the way. This is not fatal.
We have a nature columnist, and he covers nature in the Rust Belt, and he does these incredible stories of, you know, just goes out and does weird fishing adventures or insect adventures and writes about those. So the last month he spent a lot of time with salamanders who come out, last month, and they have sex and then they go back under, and it's like this moment where you get to catch them in the act.
Okay. That explains the title, then. The Salamander Gauntlet. What else says? Avoiding raccoons, sexual parasitism.
Right. So salamanders are pretty freaky.
This is all salamanders are
talking
about?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's what they do.
And suburban sprawl. So it's all about salamanders.
Well, trying. if you get rid of the salamander habitats with suburban sprawl, then you have problems.
Yeah. And the other thing that comes up, and certainly in the anthology stuff, is like... The rich history of Cleveland and the individual neighborhoods. It's almost like the neighborhood formed as little cities.
Right.
And eventually they became part of something bigger. And I was looking at a Tremont.
Right.
Amazing. It was the biggest camp in the Civil War.
Yep.
Right here. And the ships were made here. And the iron came in on Lake Superior and the ships were made. It was incredibly important.
Absolutely, and then it was sort of a bedroom community for the mill workers, and now it's hipster heaven.
Hipster heaven. Well, that's good too.
Right. Yep. But yes, and in fact, we're doing another book that comes out next month called the Cleveland Neighborhood Guidebook, which is a collection of essays just about Cleveland neighborhoods.
And then there's this other thing because that brought in all the immigrants to work.
That's right.
The Irish, the Poles, the Greeks, the Ukrainians, Hispanics, to work in that, and now there's just this feeling that further immigration is what, not necessary or not desirable. Is that feeling here? Is that the feeling here in Cleveland or not? It seems to be the feeling almost everywhere now.
Well, I can't speak for all of Cleveland, but I think what Cleveland really would benefit from is a lot more people.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people in the world who need a great place to live, and we should welcome them, and we should do everything we can to attract more immigrants.
I agree so. Well, I'd like to talk more about the salamanders, and there's so much more to talk about, but I'm afraid we don't have time to do it. Anne Trubeck, thank you so much. Belt Magazine, look for it. Unique. You'll love it. It's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Michael.
See you back in Madison, maybe. Yeah. Drop by. We'll talk. We'll have a cup of coffee. I love what she's doing. She's doing all these...